They like it or not, they work better than anything. In Israel, 99.9% successful. Think of it. I spoke to Benjamin Netanyahu, Prime Minister, 2 days ago. We were talking about it. He said it's 99.9. I mean, he came up. I didn't ask. I said 99.9% successful.
If no deal is reached, the government will go into partial shutdown at midnight tonight. Some of the agencies that will be most affected by the possible shutdown include those dealing with Homeland Security, law enforcement, national parks, transportation, and housing. Hundreds of thousands of government workers will not be paid if that shutdown happens. President Trump now says if the shutdown occurs, it's the Democrats' fault. Last week, he said he was proud to own the government shutdown if the wall isn't funded. Reports emerged Thursday that acting U.S. Attorney General Matt Whitaker refused to heed the advance of a Justice Department ethics official who said Whitaker should recuse himself from overseeing Special Counsel Robert Mueller's Russia probe. While Whitaker was not legally required to recuse himself, he was advised to do so because of the possible appearance of a conflict of interest based on Whitaker's past public remarks against the Mueller inquiry. He once referred to the probe as a witch hunt. This follows the news that William Barr, President Trump's nominee to be the next attorney general, sent an unsolicited memo to the Justice Department in June criticizing Mueller's probe. Barr stated in the memo that Trump did not obstruct justice when he asked former FBI Director James Comey to drop his investigation into former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn. Trump went on to fire James Comey. The Trump administration announced Thursday it'll start sending asylum seekers who enter the U.S. on the southern border back to Mexico while they wait for the outcome of their claims. The new policy was apparently imposed on the Mexican government by the United States. Mexico's agreed to allow Central American migrants to work and travel within Mexico while waiting on the U.S. asylum process. Under the current system, it can take months or even years to process asylum claims. Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen announced the new policy at a heated congressional hearing where she was asked by Democratic Congressmember Hank Johnson, do you view those who call illegal aliens to be human or subhuman?
Do you view those who you call illegal aliens to be human or subhuman?
Illegal aliens are human, sir.
In more news from the Trump administration, the Treasury Department announced Wednesday it'll lift sanctions on Russian oligarch Oleg Deripaska's businesses. The companies were sanctioned in April after Deripaska was accused of, quote, threatening the lives of business rivals, illegally wiretapping a government official, and taking part in extortion and racketeering, unquote. Deripaska himself will still be subject to sanctions. Deripaska, who has close ties with Russian President Vladimir Putin, has appeared in Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation into Russian election interference in connection with his dealings with former Trump campaign chair Paul Manafort. The Justice Department has charged two Chinese nationals in a worldwide 12-year hacking campaign that included the U.S. government and military as targets. The hackers are said to be part of a network connected to Chinese intelligence and successfully penetrated multiple government agencies, the U.S. Attorney's Office in New York, NASA, and the Navy, among others. The personal information of more than 100,000 Navy personnel was reportedly stolen in the cyber attack. In California, Yemeni mother Shaima Suila has reunited with her dying two-year-old son. After being granted a State Department waiver from President Trump's travel ban earlier this week, the toddler, Abdullah Hassan, is in Oakland Children's Hospital with a rare brain disease. Both Abdullah and his father, Ali, are U.S. citizens, but the mother, Shaima Suila, is a Yemeni citizen living in Egypt. Yemen is one of the five majority Muslim countries whose citizens are barred from entering the U.S. under Trump's executive order. This is attorney Banan Alakras speaking as Suila landed at the San Francisco airport.
Let's be clear. Issuance of her visa this week was not an act of kindness on their part. The Embassy and Department of State had a legal obligation to adjudicate Shaima's waiver request within a reasonable amount of time, and they failed on that obligation. The result of that failure is that a dying two-year-old boy has suffered for the last 2 months without his mother by his side.
The court has acquitted 40 NGO workers, including citizens from the U.S. and other countries, after a retrial of a case dating back to 2013, when 43 people were arrested and convicted of illegally using foreign funds to stir up opposition to the former military government. Many of the foreign defendants, including 15 Americans, left Egypt after posting bail in 2013 and were sentenced in absentia. At a Christmas address at the Vatican today, Pope Francis pledged the Catholic Church will never again cover up sexual abuse and said clergy members who are guilty of sexually abusing children should turn themselves in. He added they should, quote, prepare for divine justice, unquote. The Catholic Church has been rocked by the ongoing sexual abuse crisis over the past year, which reached all the way to Pope Francis's inner circle, with two cardinals last week being removed as his close advisors and a third stepping down. Top members of the clergy were expelled or resigned in countries around the world. In May, every bishop in Chile offered their resignation as the scandal exploded there. Here in the U.S., a Pennsylvania grand jury investigation revealed systematic, widespread sexual abuse in the church. The Justice Department has opened investigations into several dioceses around the country. In Britain, Gatwick Airport has started to resume flights after drone sightings on Wednesday and Thursday shut down service for over a day, causing passenger chaos as flights were canceled, postponed, or rerouted. Authorities say they still don't know who is behind the unmanned aerial drones. In environmental news, Washington, D.C., city lawmakers voted unanimously on a clean energy bill mandating 100% renewable electricity by 2032. The legislation also requires public transportation and fleet vehicles achieve zero carbon emissions by 2045. The mandate would apply to government buildings in the Capitol, including the White House. The Trump administration has been blasted by environmental groups for feverishly rolling back emissions limits and other environmental regulations. And in France, four environmental groups are planning possible legal action against the government for failing to effectively respond to climate change. This is the director of Greenpeace France.
We are issuing a legal complaint against the French government because we think that the French government doesn't do enough to tackle climate change. So this is why we are trying to sue the French government to ensure that they can ramp up their ambition in terms of fighting climate change, which is not the situation right now.
That's Jean-François Julliard. Over 1.2 million people had signed an online petition as of Friday morning in support of the legal action. The government of France, President Emmanuel Macron, has come under fire before for its response to the climate crisis. In August, the French environment minister, Nicolas Hulot, resigned live on a radio show due to the country's failure to adequately address climate change and other environmental threats, he said. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We begin today's show looking at Secretary of Defense James Mattis, who has announced he's resigning at the end of February while publicly rebuking President Trump's foreign policy. Mattis resigned one day after President Trump ordered the withdrawal of all 2,000 U.S. troops from Syria, and on the same day reports emerged that Trump has ordered the withdrawal of about 7,000 troops from Afghanistan. That's about half the current U.S. force there. In his resignation letter, General Mattis, four-star general, implicitly criticized President Trump's foreign policy. He wrote, "My views on treating allies with respect and also being clear-eyed about both malign actors and strategic competitors are strongly held and informed by over four decades of immersion in these issues. We must do everything possible to advance an international order that is most conducive to our security, prosperity, and values, and we are strengthened in this effort by the solidarity of our alliances." Unquote. Mattis went on to say, because you have the right to have a Secretary of Defense whose views are better aligned with yours on these and other subjects, I believe it's right for me to step down from my position, he said. In the letter, Mattis did not make a direct reference to Syria, but he did call out Russia and China. The New York Times reports Mattis is the first prominent cabinet member to resign in protest over a national security issue in almost 40 years. Much of the Washington establishment expressed shock over Mattis's resignation. Democratic Senator Mark Warner of Virginia said, quote, "This is scary. Secretary Mattis has been an island of stability amidst the chaos of the Trump administration." Republican Senator Mark Rubio of Florida responded to Mattis's resignation, saying, "It makes it abundantly clear that we're headed towards a series of grave policy errors which will endanger our nation, damage our alliances, and empower our adversaries," unquote. Prior to his time at the Pentagon, Mattis served as head of U.S. Central Command and as a supreme allied commander of NATO. In 2004, he led the U.S. Marine attack on the Iraqi city of Fallujah. In May of 2004, he ordered an attack on a wedding party near Syria. 42 civilians were reportedly killed, including 13 children. We turn now to Andrew Bacevich, a retired colonel and Vietnam War veteran. He's the author of several books, including his latest, Twilight of the American Century. His other books include America's War for the Greater Middle East, A Military History, and Washington Rules, America's Path to Permanent War. He's Professor Emeritus of International Relations and History at Boston University. He also lost his son in Iraq. Professor Andrew Bacevich, welcome back to Democracy Now! Respond to the resignation of the Secretary of Defense, and then if this were President Obama, and he was announcing the pullout of troops from Syria and half the force from Afghanistan, wouldn't the peace movement be celebrating? What is your response?
Well, this is an interesting situation. I have to think that Trump must have expected that this abrupt announcement of a withdrawal from Syria would lead to Mattis's resignation, and it probably is something that Trump welcomes. There is no question that Mattis has been an obstacle to Trump's efforts to reorient U.S. policy, particularly U.S. policy in the Middle East. You know, Mattis's letter of resignation that you quoted when he talked about his four decades of engagement with these matters is very telling. He represents the establishment's perspective that has evolved over the course of those four decades. And for anyone who looks at U.S. policy over the past four decades, particularly in the Middle East, and says, yeah, it's really going well, then I would think that they would view Mattis's resignation as a disappointment. Now, when Trump ran for the presidency, he denounced our wars in the Middle East. He promised to withdraw militarily from the Middle East. 2 years into his presidency, that hasn't happened. And in many respects, Mattis has been among those who frustrated the president's efforts. He's the commander in chief, and yet he seems not to be able to get things done. So here he is acting as the commander in chief. Now, I'm in the camp who thinks that we ought to wind down these wars, that we've got more important things to do. My only problem with Trump's decision is that, like so many of Trump's decisions, it's done impetuously, overnight, not having been thought through, not having been coordinated. Yes, let's get out of Syria, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't have a policy with respect to the civil war in Syria. I think that the way Trump is approaching this thing, we don't have any policy, and that's going to be a problem.
Do you think there's a connection to the murder of Jamal Khashoggi? And let me explain. You have the CIA saying they believe that the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia was responsible for his death and dismemberment in Istanbul in the Saudi consulate. So you then have President Trump dealing with Erdogan. And apparently this week they had a conversation. There's this threat of Erdogan that he's going to go after the Kurds. These are the U.S. allies, the Kurdish soldiers in Syria. And Trump, perhaps Erdogan knows something more about the murder, certainly has been releasing information that makes the Trump administration look very bad in their support of the Crown Prince. Also, Jared Kushner, his son-in-law, so close to and advising the Crown Prince and dealing with this murder. that Erdogan says, we're going to attack the Kurds. You got to stop being there and protecting them. And so Trump announces he's pulling out.
I think my answer to your question is, I really don't know. And I think one of the things that's important here is the difficulty of knowing whether when Trump makes these decisions, there really is any, that he has any larger purpose in mind at all. As I said, when he ran for the presidency, he ran as an anti-war candidate. Now, whether or not he ran as an anti-war candidate because of some principled opposition to the wars that he inherited, or whether he did it because he thought it was a way to win votes, is impossible to say. Where we find ourselves at the present moment, and I do think it's a huge problem, is that his commitment to Saudi Arabia, combined with the reaffirmation of the U.S. commitment to Israel, to my mind, creates the likelihood that the United States is going to continue to contribute to disorder and stability in the region, as we have done ever since the George W. Bush administration invaded Iraq in 2003. That is to say, despite this withdrawal from Syria, which if it actually happens, you know, so many times he announces something and then reverses course, but even assuming that the withdrawal from Syria happens, it doesn't necessarily follow that we have anything like a coherent policy in the region. So the people who get excited about Mattis's resignation and see the possibility there of chaos, of confusion, of disorder, I think their fears are justified. That said, what they seem to not focus on is that the course that Mattis represented, that is to say, the continuation of U.S. wars in the Middle East that have produced nothing positive, that supposed wisdom was not going to, it has not and would not produce anything positive, no matter how long we persist.
Let me play a clip for you of Phyllis Bennis. We spoke to her on Thursday right after the announcement about Syria, U.S. pulling out all 2,000 troops. This was her response.
We do know that the warplanes and the drones are going to continue to be bombing in Syria, and it's those U.S. bombs and U.S. coalition-led bombs that are creating enormous pressure, wreaking enormous havoc on the people of Syria. Again, this is something that Yazan spoke about very eloquently. When we look at Raqqa, when we look at the other cities that have been largely destroyed by U.S. bombing after being under attack, both people and the infrastructure of cities, by ISIS. This is not going to qualitatively change that on the ground. The presence
this of this is not of going to qualitatively change things on the ground. So, Andrew Bacevich, for those who think that the U.S. won't be involved in the bombing of Syria, that it would make it more an air war, along the lines of the U.S.-backed Saudi bombing of Yemen right now.
I think she's making a great point, that you don't have to have troops on the ground in order to engage in war. You don't have to have troops on the ground to engage in wars that are stupid and counterproductive. We have far fewer troops in Afghanistan today than we did in past years. Trump wants to have even fewer still. And yet, if I'm not mistaken, the number of airstrikes, U.S. airstrikes in Afghanistan over the course of the Trump administration has increased substantially. So the wars continue. The fundamental question, it seems to me, is, does the continuation of these wars contribute, are they politically purposeful? Do they contribute to some outcome that either advances U.S. interests or is consistent with our ostensible moral values? And the answer, of course, is no. But again, it's not as if Secretary Mattis, this supposed font of wisdom, was offering any alternative, any course of action that would bring a rationale to our policy in the Middle East, would cause these wars to make strategic sense. Basically, he and so much of the national security establishment wants to continue these wars because the truth is they can't think of any alternative other than press on.
It might be interesting to listen to all the Republicans and Democrats who were saying this is a terrible idea, pulling the troops out, that we were just on the brink of victory in wiping out ISIS there, when others might say, where was evidence of that? Could you talk about Mattis's history, General Mattis's history? For example, The Intercept pointing out in 2004, it was Mattis who planned the Marine assault on Fallujah that reduced the Iraqi city to rubble, forcing 200,000 residents from their homes. And according to the Red Cross, at least 800 civilians were killed.
Well, he is undoubtedly a distinguished soldier, as that word distinguished gets defined in military circles. He is a competent professional. He is a master of his trade. I think he is wouldn't want to compare it with Petraeus, but he has a certain skill, I think, in relating to the press and therefore in creating an image that goes down well in Washington circles as the thoughtful warrior. Apparently, he is quite well read. My problem is that he's a conventional soldier with a conventional mindset, totally unimaginative. Again, and this is I hate to suggest that I sympathize with the president or agree with the president, but for whatever caused Trump back in 2016 to say, elect me president because I know our wars in the Middle East are stupid and they need to end, he was on to something. And Mattis, as a representative of the national security establishment, is unable to acknowledge the essential truth of Trump's statement. He is unable to acknowledge that since 2003 in particular, although arguably you could choose an earlier day, but since 2003 in particular, we have gone down a path that is self-destructive, is mindless, and the only way to get out of the mess we're in is to make a radical course change. Now, it needs to be a radical course change that is thought through, coordinated in advance, debated, groundwork laid, not simply as Trump tends to do, get up in the morning and announce that he's made a decision. But there will be no change of course as long as people like Mattis are running national security policy.
So in this last minute that we have, it's not clear that Trump will move forward with this, as he hasn't with so many other things, or will move forward with something that no one ever predicted. Right. Who knows, because right. There's such massive pressure on him right now, and who he will right. nominate as the next defense secretary. You know, Lindsey Graham has been vying for it, but he's one of the fiercest critics of Trump right now on this issue. But if he does move forward, and he halves the U.S. force in Afghanistan, he pulls out thousands of soldiers from Syria, the whole force, what should happen next? What would you think is a rational U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East?
Well, I think at the present moment, the nexus of the issue is this competition between Saudi Arabia and Iran to dominate the Persian Gulf. And the Trump administration has affirmed that we side with Saudi Arabia against Iran. I think that strategically that makes no sense whatsoever. I think that if you think about the long-term prospects of nations in that part of the world, Iran, A, will continue to exist, and B, will continue to be an important actor. And therefore, in the long run, we need to find a way to reconcile with, or at least coexist with, Iran. So we need to find a way to remove ourselves from the Saudi camp and to take a more balanced position. I don't mean for a second to suggest that this is easily done or could be done overnight, but we need to have balance, not total disengagement, but a lower military profile, and to therefore diplomatically seek to find ways to restore some semblance of order in that region when our military efforts to transform the region have simply created great disorder and damage to ourselves and to others.
I want to thank you for being with us, retired Colonel, Vietnam War vet, author of a number of books, including Twilight of the American Century. His other books include America's War for the Greater Middle East, A Military History, and Washington Rules, America's Path to Permanent War. He's Professor Emeritus of International Relations and History at Boston University. When we come back, a prison reform bill poised to be signed by President Trump. Stay with us. One for Electric Guitar by Glenn Branca. Branca died earlier this year at the age of 69. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As we turn to look at a major criminal justice reform bill that may soon become law after the U.S. House of Representatives overwhelmingly voted in its favor Thursday, it's called the First Step Act, the bipartisan measure, which passed in the Senate earlier this week with an unheard-of 87-12 vote, would roll back sentences for federal prisoners, including mandatory life terms for third-time offenders, as well as mandatory minimum sentences for nonviolent drug users and those convicted of firearm crimes. The bill is now heading to the desk of President Trump, who's pledged to sign it into law perhaps today. The bill only affects federal prisoners who make up less than 10% of the more than 2 million U.S. prisoners. The U.S. has the largest prison population in the world. The First Step Act ends sentencing disparities for convictions of crack cocaine versus powder cocaine, a distinction that's long led to deep racial disparities in prison terms. This is Democratic Senator Dick Durbin speaking shortly after the Senate vote.
Let me preface my remarks by telling you about the worst vote I ever cast as a member of Congress. You don't hear many senators stand up and say, let me tell you about my worst vote. Well, I can tell you it was in the House of Representatives. It was 1986. And because we were scared to death of crack cocaine, which was now showing up all over America, we created a 100-to-1 disparity between crack cocaine and powder cocaine sentencing. The net result of that, we thought, would be to scare America straight in terms of the danger of this drug, and it backfired. It turned out we had more drugs on the street. We had a lower price for the drugs that were out there because of the burgeoning supply, and we started filling up our jails with people who were arrested for drug offenses, a 700% increase in our jail population because of this new level of our war on drugs. I voted for it. A lot of Democrats did. We're not finished. It's entitled The First Step. What's the second step? The second step is to learn from this experience and to find a way to reduce incarceration while still reducing the crime rate in America.
The bill has been endorsed by a wide range of supporters across the political spectrum, from the American Civil Liberties Union to the conservative Koch brothers. It's also a major priority of senior White House advisor, presidential son-in-law Jared Kushner, whose father spent time in a federal prison for tax evasion and other charges. For more, we go to Washington, D.C., where we're joined by Van Jones, president and co-founder of Cut 50, a national bipartisan initiative to reduce the U.S. incarcerated population by half over the next 10 years. Van Jones was President Barack Obama's green jobs advisor in 2009, founded Green for All, also CNN political commentator, and also with us, Jessica Jackson Sloan, human rights attorney, co-founder and national director of Cut 50. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Van, let's begin with you. How did this happen? Do you think it will be signed today? What is most significant? What are you most proud of with this prison reform bill?
I believe it will be signed today. Here's what happened. Formerly incarcerated people, directly impacted family members, said we are not going to let the Trump administration go on criminal justice reform the way they went on immigration and on guns and on climate and every other issue and poison the well. We are going to insist that the momentum that was developed under President Obama carry forward. And those groups, you know, mainly led by Cut 50, found an ally in Jared Kushner, whose, again, father went to prison and who wanted to make a difference. And it was the most remarkable thing to see Trump, who came into office talking about law and order and embracing the Blue Lives Matter movement and talking about American carnage and putting Jeff Sessions in place, really moving in a very negative direction, over the past year began to turn. Kim Kardashian went in there and got him to release Miss Alice Johnson. He began to add to his speeches some of the things he was hearing from formerly incarcerated people and from Jared. And we ultimately were able to build, I think, the biggest bipartisan movement in the country and got 87 senators to vote with us earlier this week. You can't get 87 senators to vote together to change the name of a post office anymore. But on this issue, we finally had a breakthrough.
So I want to go to the woman you just referred to, Alice Marie Johnson. Earlier this year, President Trump commuted her life sentence. She was in prison for a first-time nonviolent drug offense after her cause was taken up by the reality television star Kim Kardashian West. Alice Marie Johnson, 63-year-old grandmother from Memphis, released Wednesday from federal prison, released a while ago from federal prison in Aliceville, Alabama, where she'd been serving her sentence for nearly 22 years. This is Johnson speaking after her release.
When the criteria came out for clemency, I thought for sure, in fact, I was certain that I'd met and exceeded all of the criteria. I had 100% clear conduct for the entire time of my entire time in prison, no disciplinary infraction. I'm a true first-time nonviolent offender. Even the prison staff wrote letters about my accomplishments in prison. I had letters from members of Congress, the outside public. Oh my goodness, I had so much support. I was denied again with no explanation given. So it leaves me wondering what more I could have done.
That was Alice Marie Johnson speaking while she was still jailed. But she is free. Earlier this year, Kim Kardashian West spoke to Mike about her meeting with Donald Trump on behalf of Alice Marie Johnson.
Me and Sean to really talk to the president about Alice Johnson and really explain to him why she would be such a good person to grant clemency to. I just feel really strongly that she has such a good support system. She has a job waiting for her. She has a home to go to, and she has such a great supportive family that just even seeing the work that she's done while she's in prison, knowing that she would never get out. You know, she's done her time. I mean, she's done almost 22 years. You know, I think in life, everyone makes mistakes, and she really deserves a second chance.
So, yes, that's Kim Kardashian. She met with the president, and Alice Marie Johnson was freed a few months ago. Jessica Jackson Sloan, talk about the significance of this moment and then how you overcame the opposition of so many Republicans like Tom Cotton, for example, from Arkansas and others. I mean, 87 to 12.
Yeah. No, this is a historic moment. This is a moment where you not only have Republicans and Democrats coming together, you've got people from all across the country. Like Van said, the formerly incarcerated leaders who said, enough is enough. We're not going to tell our people inside that they've got to wait another 4 years before they can get any kind of relief. We're going to keep fighting. They stepped up. They organized in their states. You've got media from all over the country, everything from the Lexington Courier to the New York Times, saying this is one of the most significant criminal justice reforms and that Trump needed to get this done and Congress needed to get this done. You've got the National Association of Manufacturers. You've got Verizon. You've got the U.S. Chambers Association.
Fox News.
Fox News Broadcasting. All coming together saying, you know, we've got to get this done. So I think while this is an epic reform for all the reasons you laid out in the beginning, I also think this is a huge moment in the narrative around criminal justice reform. For decades, we've been hearing this Willie Horton narrative. Don't let people out or they're going to end up reoffending and there's going to be victims and you'll never be elected again. Miss Alice and this First Step Act are the antidote to the Willie Horton narrative. This is a turning point for the entire movement in the entire country.
So if you could tell us, Jessica, your own story, how you got involved, your own husband in prison.
Yes. When I was 22 years old, I had nothing but a GED and a two-month-old daughter. I found myself standing in a courtroom in Georgia watching as my husband got sentenced to 15, serve six. This was, in my mind at the time, I thought it was a fluke. I knew he was a great dad. I knew he was a great husband. I knew he was a boss to 17 people and he showed up for work every morning on time. I knew what a great guy he was. And to watch the system just take all that away and watch us go into financial ruin and my daughter grow up without her dad there just because he had a drug addiction. And then watch, you know, as he stayed through the system, not getting any help. That's what motivated me to get involved. And I think those personal experiences are what have motivated everybody from Jared Kushner to Sean Hopwood to many of these advocates who have been out there fighting for this bill and saying it's time to get some relief.
So, Van, if you could talk about, well, I mean, some might say perhaps this was passed by many Republicans because so many Republicans are facing prison right now around the administration and others. Michelle Goldberg has a very interesting op-ed piece in the New York Times. The headline, Donald Trump is doing something good. Conservatives get serious about criminal justice reform. But she lays out the number of conservative political actors, not meaning the Hollywood actors, but who did go to prison. I mean, people like Chuck Colson of Watergate fame, who goes to prison and gets deeply involved with the prison reform movement, right through right now to Kevin Ring, president of the criminal justice reform organization Family Against Mandatory Minimums, a former Republican Hill staff member who once helped draft a law imposing mandatory minimums for meth dealers.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the actual thing is happening. The incarceration industry has gotten so big, mass incarceration has gotten so massive, that now Republicans, Democrats, white folks, black folks, brown folks, poor folks, even some rich folks sometimes wind up getting pulled in. And when you get pulled in, or a family member gets pulled in, or a neighbor gets pulled in, or a coworker gets pulled in, you realize we have unleashed a horror on this country. And you cannot get out of it. You've got to do something about it. And so you do have people who are directly impacted on both sides of the aisle now, who fought until the last dog barked, who backed McConnell down, who beat the dog crap out of Tom Cotton and won this thing because people...
Cotton remains opposed.
Yeah, well, Tom remains opposed. He got 11 votes he got destroyed because that old law and order, scare everybody crap, he tried to pull that stuff and Republicans voted him down. And so you're in a situation now where there is a change has begun to happen. And, you know, this idea that, you know, Trump is just doing this because he's going to go to jail or whatever. Look, Trump could just pardon all his family members right now and be done with it and just walk off. I think that something has happened.
Not for the New York investigations.
Well, I'm just saying that for most of these, I think the cynicism, and Amy, I got to speak to this, the level of cynicism and pain and frustration that is now built up on the left because of this nightmare in the White House should not rob us of a victory that we have fought for now for 25 years, long before any of these people were in office. People like me and people who are listening to this radio station have been fighting at the local level, and we have finally come to a point where even the Republican Party agrees with us. And I don't want any of your listeners to say, well, I'm not going to believe something good is happening. No, when we fight and we don't give up, good things can happen even under the Trump administration. Let's not let the cynicism take that away.
And let me ask you about Jared Kushner. This all happening, something he is very much pushing and getting credit for, in this period of time, these months, when he's been an advisor to the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, how to get out of these accusations that he was responsible for murdering the journalist Jamal Khashoggi. Your thoughts on this? You even got to, you work with him all the time, but you even got to interview him on this subject.
Yeah, sure. Listen, I disagree with the Trump administration on many things. I always say I got 99 conflicts with the Trump administration, but prisons ain't one. And so I'm not here to try to litigate everything that they've done. But what I can say about Jared Kushner is on this issue, he has been relentless. He's been dogged. Everything he said he would do, he has done, which I can't say about most of the Democrats involved, frankly, or most of the Republicans. And so on this issue, I can say to you and to anybody else, and Amy, as you know, I'm a founder of the Ella Baker Center for Human Rights. We helped to close 5 abusive youth prisons in California, stop the super jail. I'm not a newcomer to this issue. Before I was ever on CNN, I was fighting on this issue. And I can say that Jared Kushner on this issue has been as dogged and determined as any other impacted family member in this movement.
So let's talk about some of the progressive groups like the Movement for Black Lives, the coalition of more than 150 black-led organizations. Has come out against the First Step Act. They wrote a statement, quote, this bill is custom made for rich white men. All the carve-outs make the vast majority of our people ineligible for the benefits of the bill. Moreover, by mandating post-release surveillance, the bill opens the door to increased privatization while causing additional harm to the most marginalized of our people. We believe all of this will be done while giving liberal cover to the Trump administration as they attack, cage, and warehouse black, brown, and working class people across the country. The Movement for Black Lives also points out the bill explicitly excludes immigrants from access to early release and rehab programs and will direct money saved from early releases to go back into law enforcement. They say the bill encourages profiteering and makes false promises about bringing black prisoners home. Your thoughts, Van?
Well, I'll say they should have told the Congressional Black Caucus that because the vast majority of black lawmakers voted for it. Some of those things are not accurate. Let me say this. Jessica Smarter on the policy. Let me just say this. It's called the First Step Act. Not the Last Step Act. It's the First Step Act. This bill does not do any harm to anyone. The goodness in the bill doesn't get to as many people. There's good programs in there that don't everybody can't participate in. The goodness in the bill doesn't get to as many people as we want to, but there is not one additional piece of harm. Not one sentence gets any longer. Nobody serves an extra day. And that by itself is something of a victory. And I'll say more after Jessica.
So I just wanted to jump in and correct some of that misinformation because I just don't want to have viewers listening and thinking that that is true. And it's just not. I've seen the numbers. The U.S. Sentencing Commission actually did an analysis. And the exclusions actually are pretty much across the board for white, black, and Hispanic individuals. Those exclusions are for a small part of the bill. The time credits that people can earn by doing programming. There are plenty of pieces of the bill that do apply to everybody who's inside of the prison, regardless of what crime they committed, including the increased good time credit that people can earn off of their sentence for good behavior. I also want to point to the crack cocaine retroactivity. That disproportionately is going to impact African Americans who are inside. There are going to be a lot more African Americans coming home in this first batch of individuals who are coming home than any other race. And that is because people fought very, very hard, Dick Durbin in particular, to make sure that nothing went forward that didn't include a massive fix of retroactivity on the Fair Sentencing Act, which had been passed almost a decade ago. So I just want to correct some of that misinformation. On the immigrants piece also, I'm sorry we couldn't get away with getting rid of the current ban on people who are here undocumented going to halfway houses. We tried, we pushed, we were unable to get away from it, but it is just a continuation of the status quo. So I just wanted to address those couple points and invite people to look at firststepact.org if they want to check out all the wonderful things that are in this bill.
And how you extend this beyond federal prisoners, this deals with 10%, right? 200,000 prisoners in federal prison. What about now the model being for all prisoners? What's your next step, Jessica?
Well, you know, we're already getting calls from state legislators across the country asking us, can we do this in my state? What can we do in my state? And not just Democratic state legislators. Both sides of the aisle now feel comfortable. They're seeing there was a clear mandate by Congress, 87 to 12. 358 to 35. I mean, just a mandate, and every single one of the amendments meant to be poison pills slapped down. So they're wanting to get going in their own states. This really has made an impact on the narrative, and I think we're going to see a lot of trickle-down justice coming from this bill.
I want to thank you both for being with us. Van, you wanted to say something? 10 seconds.
So, I just want to add one thing. This actually may take off the table criminal justice as a weapon against Democrats in 2020 for the first time since 1988 with Willie Horton. You now have, because Republicans are embracing, for whatever reason, Trump embracing, for whatever reason, now it's a lot harder to say that progressives and Democrats are going to make you less safe when literally you have both parties on one accord. So politically, this is very, very smart for Democrats and progressives. We are now more safe than ever to keep pushing for progress.
I want to thank you both for being with us. Jessica Jackson Sloan, co-founder and national director of Cut 50. Van Jones, president and co-founder of Cut 50, also commentator on CNN. This is Democracy Now! By the way, tune in on Monday to Democracy Now! In one of our holiday specials, an hour with Angela Davis. She talks about her life in prison, outside, professor, philosopher, activist. That's Monday on Democracy Now! This is Democracy Now! When we come back, Nanette Barragan will join us. She just came back from the U.S.-Mexico border, where she personally facilitated the crossing of Maria, a Honduran mother who was made famous by the video of U.S. border guards tear gassing as she took her children across the border this week. Stay with us. Goo-goo wah-wah by Wawa Watson. That's Melvin Wawa Watson Reagan, master of the Wawa pedal, died in October at the age of 67. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Nearly a month after a photo of a Honduran mother and her small kids fleeing tear gas fired by U.S. Border Patrol captivated the nation, 39-year-old Maria Meza was finally admitted into the United States this week with her five children, and their asylum request is now being processed. But this came only after California Congress members Jimmy Gomez and Nanette Barragan intervened on her behalf, camping out with Mesa's family and other migrants on the U.S. side of the border near the Otay Mesa port of entry between Tijuana and San Diego, surrounded by metal barriers and border guards and riot gear. The lawmakers were at the border to investigate claims the Trump administration's rejecting asylum seekers at official ports of entry, violating international and national law. California Congressmember Nanette Barragan joins us now from Washington, D.C. She's a member of the House Committee on Homeland Security, just back from the border. Congressmember Barragan, thanks so much for being with us. Describe what you did this past Monday.
Well, I went down to Otay Mesa, which is a port of entry down in Mexico, with one of my colleagues. We were asked to go down to observe as Maria was going to cross and present herself for asylum.
So explain exactly what you did. Democracy Now! Was recently on the border. We saw people for hours, for days, not being let into the U.S. You did something incredible. Somehow you got Maria and her family over the line into the U.S., which is still before the border guards.
Well, it was an interesting thing to see at Otay Mesa. What happens is the U.S., Mexico line actually occurs before you get to a CBP border agent. And so we were able to walk right up to the agent, which crossed over into U.S. territory, where her lawyers were ahead of her and said, we want to present our client for asylum. Now, while they were talking to the CBP officer, Maria, her children, along with eight unaccompanied minors and another male, were able to just walk onto U.S. soil. And so it was an interesting thing because you had a CBP officer about, I'm going to guess, about 7 feet into U.S. territory.
So explain what you're demanding now. Not only for Maria, we just got the news that the U.S. is going to send immigrants who are being asylum seekers back to Mexico while they wait, which could take weeks, months, what, years?
Yeah, it's a very dangerous policy to have people waiting in Mexico. If you go down there and you take a look at the conditions, it's not very sanitary. But not only that, people are being searched out. In this case, Maria actually had some of the right ringers were trying to find her. They had to hide her and her family. They had to move her. You can just imagine what it's like. We are also hearing the reports of the two young teenagers that were killed there. Mm-hmm. It's not a situation where you want to put people who are fleeing violence to stay in a place where there is violence and still putting them in danger.
So the investigations of right now, there's a 5-month-old who's in the hospital who is being held by ICE in the freezing cold, what they call ice boxes. And then you have the horror of the story of Jacqueline, the 7-year-old indigenous Guatemalan girl who died in Border Patrol custody. What are you demanding on the Homeland Security Committee in terms of investigations of all of this, Nanette?
Well, we certainly want to investigate the circumstance of what happened. Now, let me tell you, just being at the border with Maria and her children and seeing how CBP responded, I can actually understand now why we are hearing more and more reports of children being ill, of children dying. In our situation, you had Customs and Border Protection officers sitting right there, allowing 3- and 4-year-old children waiting hours on end. In Maria's case, 9 hours in the cold, on the cement. They could go nowhere to eat. They couldn't even get up to go to the bathroom because if they left this little patch of U.S. soil, Mexican immigration officials and police were on the Mexico line just waiting for them. And so to see the disregard that some of the officers at CBP had for migrants was just disturbing to see and hear. We even had a CBP officer who was talking out loud about how terrible migrants were, how they were coming to commit crime. And so if they have this attitude, they really aren't going to have any regard for human life and their dignity. Now, let me tell you, there are good CBP agents. I represent a port of entry, but there are bad apples, and that's a real issue. So we want to make sure that there is an investigation on what happens. We want to make sure it doesn't happen again. In the case of Jacqueline, we want to also make sure that we put in standards and procedures so that there's a real medical screening. What I understand happened in Jacqueline's case, it could be something as simple as them asking, is everybody okay? That is not what you need to do so that you can make sure and ensure that children are okay.
I want to ask you to stay with us so we can do part two of this discussion.
I believe they would have seen that she was not well and would have got medical attention much sooner. my colleague, Dr. Raul Ruiz, who
We're going to have to leave it there, but we will do part two. And
this is CKMS, 102.7 FM in Waterloo Region, radiowaterloo.ca on the web.
CKMS, 102.7 FM, your community radio. CKMS 102.7 FM, tu radio comunitaria.
This is a CKMS historical moment. In 1992, CKMS receives the boost to 250 watts. It changes to 100.3 on the FM dial. On October 15th of the same year, CKMS marks its 15th birthday by shutting down 94.5 for the last time.
Hi everybody, I am Siempre Ati, and I'm here to invite you to listen CKMS 102.7 FM, Radio Waterloo, our new frequency. Ciao!
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Unauthorized Disclosure Podcast. I'm Kevin Gastola, and I'm joined by Rania Kalik. Hey, Rania.
Hey, Kevin.
And we've got a nice episode for you. Then next week, we're going to have our final episode of the year with Manar Muhawesh, who's going to join us for a little end-of-year episode. But I guess to get started this week, we need to point the finger and make sure responsibility is placed where it belongs. Russia, right now, I have to tell you, is why it is raining outside my window.
Yeah, Russia's why I keep yawning.
And I think it's also why I had trouble starting my car this morning. And
I have to be. There must have been, like, if there have been threats of, like, engine manipulation.
It's also why the trains aren't running on time, and
it's why no one's retweeting me today. It's just one of those days.
Like, Russia has to do with why, you know, traffic to the stuff that I've been writing is just, it's just plummeted. And for whatever reason, they've decided in the past week that I don't deserve any audience for this week.
No, totally. Russia's the reason that, like, my parents don't like me. It's why my boyfriend broke up with me and why no one came to my birthday party.
Oh, that's terrible.
None of those things are true. Sorry, that would be very sad.
But, you know, it seems that...
No, listen, but in all seriousness, there are these people in France who are, like, really pissed off because their pay has been stagnant. The government keeps, like... decreasing their benefits. It's just like a rough situation financially, and so they've been protesting. But the thing is, I didn't know this, but what I recently learned is that Putin tricked them into believing that.
Mm-hmm. He tricked them into believing that they were poor.
He tricked them into believing that they're poor, and that the only way to deal with that situation is to express your discontent in the streets. And it's just really sad because, like, these people were totally fine and happy before, and then, like, Putin brainwashed them, and now they're, like, upset. And it's just, it's really a tough situation. I mean, just, like, God, Russia needs to give it a rest. I mean, this is literally, though, like, what it's like when you read Twitter. I mean, see, the unrest in France, it got so much attention, but, like, I read several articles in very mainstream publications pinning the blame. Some of the articles would be a little bit more sophisticated. Like, Max Boot in the Washington Post was like, Russia isn't the reason there's unrest, but they are certainly fueling the fire. And it's like, what do you fucking, like, what does that mean? Like, he even made, like, some weird, it was, like, he did this, like, analogy where he's like, Putin didn't start it, but he's conducting the orchestra now. And it's like, what? He didn't write it. That's what it was. Like, he didn't write the music, but he's conducting the orchestra. And it's like, first of all, that's a really stupid thing to say. And is not even a little bit smart. You stuck up snobby prick. Okay. But second of all, like, there's no evidence for that. And I just find it fascinating that, like, these people, these centrists, and of course neocons, but like these centrists continue to try to blame everything on Russia or some like outside evil actor. It used to be ISIS. It used to be Islamists. I don't know if you remember, Kevin, but back when Occupy Wall Street happened, there was actually people claiming that like Islamists were involved. That used to happen quite often. And now it's Russia. It's just amazing how seamlessly that blame game gets moved to like the new enemy.
And the failure of governance on the part of centrists, I mean, no reconciling with how, you know, you obviously have nothing to offer. Well, we know they don't really have anything to offer right-wing people because, one, they're not dealing with their discontent economically. And obviously, they don't want to give in to their ethno-nationalism and their racism, which obviously we don't want them to. But, you know, that's why they can't make them happy. And then on the left, it's like, well, you're cutting social programs. You're engaged in austerity to balance the budget. You're doing all of these things that make life worse for people. And you wonder why they don't support you. Oh, but, you know, in order to cover up the fact that you can't find a plan that can keep people from protesting, then it's got to be Russia. It's got to be that. Or it's got to be Islamists. Or it could be Iran. Maybe it's Iran that's sending people over to protest.
Yeah, some, like, officially designated enemy would just blame them for everything. But it's gotten to the point where, like, I'm not going to name any names, but, man, I know that people who are listening have seen this, too, like, someone that is like a smart person whose work you maybe follow, maybe you know them personally, and you know they're smart, like on an intellectual level, like you know they're smart, right? Maybe they've written books that you learned a lot from, or like you've seen them in interviews and they have a lot of informative things to say. And then you see them spouting this nonsense, like about, you know, like Russia is behind the French unrest. Like, I mean, I'm just like, constantly like stunned by, it's like the fucking body snatchers. It's like, oh, they got to you too, where you're just like, I mean, it's just made everyone so dumb. Like, it's unbelievable the number of people who fall for this. Like, we have a lot of inequality in the West, okay? There's a lot of inequality. People are working harder, in some cases getting paid less. They're living paycheck to paycheck. Life in that situation is difficult. Like, being saddled with debt is difficult. Having children and like, you know, not being able to, like, afford to, like, give them what they need is fucking difficult. Like, it's a difficult world we live in, and to just blame everything on Russia just, in a lot of ways, it also just shows how disconnected these people are. Like, you know, you just don't know what it's like. Like, you really don't know what it's like. Like, when I see Mira Tandon, our favorite go-to punching bag, because she just makes it so easy. But, like, she tweeted something along the lines of just, like, I don't understand why people are so mad at Macron. And it's like, I don't understand why people are so upset. And it's like, of course you don't. You're, like, a millionaire. And you support the policies that make people like us poorer. Like, of course you don't get it. It's just these people are just so, like, so disconnected. They live in this bubble and they have no idea.
Yeah, because...
And that's why they're always surprised when a right-winger, like, who beats their chest gets elected or Brexit happens. They, like, don't see it coming because they don't understand that people are hurting.
Well, it's people like her who think they're so smart and pragmatic and able to come up with fixes. And, you know, like, Center for American Progress would claim to pride itself on having solutions that split the difference and are, you know, our progressive compromises or pragmatic progressivism or whatever. And, you know, it just doesn't cut it. You're not actually addressing what people are going through. You're trying to put, like, a Band-Aid, and you're trying to suppress the anger and discontent rather than address why people are upset. And I think it's also important, before we move on, to just quickly mention that a lot of these protests, they were, you know, they didn't stay just on this issue, but didn't it come from a fuel tax?
Yes, so, ordinary people. Fuel tax on ordinary people rather than the companies who caused climate change.
So it's important to talk about, and I think people like Naomi Klein and others who have been out front on climate change activism have been pointing out that, you know, one of the failures, the chief failures of Democrats, people like Neera Tanden, these centrists, these liberal centrists, is to pass the costs of responding to climate change on to poor and working class people. And you wonder why they deny that it exists. You wonder why they seek refuge in these climate hoax and wonder why they deny science. They want to so that they can mobilize and argue that they shouldn't be enduring this sort of hardship. I mean, it shouldn't be that unfathomable. And I think it's really dangerous. I mean, I'll just give a couple quick headlines that I have in front of me. We won't spend a lot of time on climate stuff for this episode, but just, you know, in the past week, we have things like the Arctic acts as a global cooling system by reflecting solar radiation back into space. But this cooling shield is shrinking. The 12 lowest sea ice levels on record have all occurred in the last 12 years. You know, I'll give one more example. You know, we have basically the United States showing up. You know, we are responsible for more emissions than many countries combined. We show up to a UN climate meeting, and what do the people representing the Trump administration do? They're touting the value of coal. I'm not even making that up. Like, we live in such a perverted reality right now that they're saying that they're going to a meeting about how to address the climate, and they say, we need more coal. and, you know, you've even got the EPA saying that, you know, the dangers that we have are more severe than ever. And that's under Trump, when they're actually politically discouraged from making those kinds of scientific findings. But even the deniers in our government can't suppress how severe things are getting. But then as we talk about this, it's like, look, if the policies are going to be fuel taxes that are on poor and working class people, then, and we're going to blame Russia for them getting angry, then obviously not only are the people of France screwed, not only are the people, you know, who run these countries going to have turmoil, but the whole planet is basically fucked.
Yeah, we're fucked. I think we should just stop recording and just go home.
All right, that's it.
I'm just feeling we're packing it in. But like, Jesus Christ. One more thing I did want to say, though, is the tweet I was talking about from Neera Tanden before, actually what she was saying was, I don't understand, like, why are people, how can people be mad about a fuel tax for green energy? Like it's like we're addressing climate change, and it's like you said, it's offsetting, like it's putting the cost onto working class and poor people rather than the actual oil companies that caused the problem to begin with. And that is like the essence of centrism, is like living in this bubble where you don't get why that's a problem, where you don't get why it's a problem to like basically charge people who don't have money for the problem created by massive billion-dollar companies. Like, anyways, so why don't we talk about the recent death of historian William Bloom?
I want to talk about that, but is it okay if, you know, one more thing? I have a confession to make on the show. It has come to my attention that I am part of a Russian plot to undermine Americans' faith in the rule of law. Actually, let me get it completely. Yes, I am weakening faith in the rule of law and our justice system on behalf of Vladimir Putin.
As someone who used to have complete faith in the American justice system, it really wasn't until I met you, Kevin, and started listening to Brian Becker's show, which you do a segment on Sputnik. It wasn't until I heard that show that I, which is, as we know, receives funding from the Russian government, It wasn't until I heard that show that I started to suspect that perhaps the American justice system may not be quite fair.
So let me set this up just so people know exactly. There is a show that I do weekly with John Kiriakou, who is a former CIA officer. He's responsible for he went on TV and said that the Bush administration was waterboarding people and that it was torture. He became a target. They caught him sharing some information with a journalist involving the identities of undercover CIA agents. He got in trouble for it. They punished him. They put him in jail gleefully for a little more than two years. He was in prison. He does a show now with Brian Becker, who Brian Becker is a longtime left-wing activist who's been doing work. Isn't he part of PSL, I think?
I think he started it.
I think he's in D.C. He's done a lot of work. He travels a lot. He's got a lot of experience with internationalist movements in various countries throughout the world. He does a lot of left-wing organ. He knows the history of left-wing movements. He knows radical history pretty well. He was at Attica involved in supporting people when the Attica massacre was unfolding. So he's done a lot of solidarity work over time. And so they host this show and they call it Loud and Clear. And then every week on Thursdays, we do a show called Criminal Injustice. I do it myself. And then his name is Paul Wright, and he is with this outfit called Prison Legal News that's been around for a while. Paul's a former prisoner. He was incarcerated for several years. And then he developed this sort of zine or paper that could get to prisoners. And it gives people updates on what's going on in the mass incarceration system. It gives people information on how they can better defend themselves, work their cases. It was really successful, so he turned it into a publication, and it has pretty good circulation. And so anyways, we both do this show, and we were accused. It started in September, but it appears now that by Washington Post flagging it, that the researchers at the Center for Strategic and International Studies are proceeding to continue this work, and they have pegged our show on Sputnik as part of attacking democracy. I'll read the actual quote here, and this is hilariously a part of their Defending Democratic Institutions project. But I'll get to this part here that they say. So they mention our show, and they mention that there's a show on RT called America's Lawyer, which I'm not really familiar with. I'll save talking about that for another day, but they mentioned that we have a show, the Criminal Injustice segment, and this is the paragraph here that's most important. Having long realized that the most effective disinformation is based on a kernel of truth, Moscow latches on to legitimate criticisms of the justice system. Shows like America's Lawyer and the Criminal Injustice segment on Sputnik's Loud and Clear often weave genuine concerns and viable grievances in with misleading narratives. Important causes are hijacked, making Kremlin-linked outlets appear to be the champions of justice reform in the United States, while in reality, their programming is designed to exacerbate grievances and weaken our institutions.
Well, they've caught on to you, Kevin.
So they've got us. What can I say? I mean, the most amazing part, though, is that they go on, and you know how they you start from this frame, and like you've already addressed, you know, the idea that we would be undermining faith in the justice system. I mean, it's incredible. I guess Putin's been laying the groundwork for some time, because if you go back to 2010, 45% of Americans, according to the Pew Research polls that were done, we're saying there are too many prisoners incarcerated, that we have too many prisoners in the U.S. So, I mean, he really knows how to pick us apart here in the United States, I guess.
It's just like, this is like more of the blaming, like, instead of accepting the fact that, like, these are basically dissidents.
Yeah.
They're accusing dissidents of, like, only having these opinions because of Russia. like, and being part of a Russian campaign as opposed to caring about the U.S. and just using this as a platform to, like, discuss inequality and unfairness.
Well, there's that, but then the focus, I think, should also be on the money that CSIS stands to make and how they front for the military-industrial complex. So I do just want to briefly add that they talk about how they believe that Russia is going to hack and leak against the justice system. With no evidence whatsoever, they say that right now Russia's planning to penetrate court computer networks and judges' personal email accounts to expose unflattering communications, to fabricate communications, to steal information, to alter orders, to release draft decisions that haven't even been published yet. So, like, rulings.
That sounds insane.
And there is absolutely nothing in this graph to say where they get this idea. The only reason you'd have this idea is if you were a think tank that depends on military defense contractor money and cybersecurity contractor money, and you wanted to plant this fear in the minds of politicians on Capitol Hill so that they would give you more money to fund your research projects, so that they would give you more grant dollars that could then be used to give more contracts to the people in this cybersecurity industrial complex or the military industrial complex. And then that it's just part of, you know, what they're doing. I mean, we know that, like, I have some of the stuff in front of me just to quickly say that, you know, Northrop Grumman gives them about $500,000 to fund their think tank. They built their office with $1 million from the United Arab Emirates, by the way. So as far as, like, undermining faith in the rule of law and justice, I mean, you're taking a lot of money from the this Gulf state that has been responsible for so much, like, human rights abuse and whatever, and but yet it's us, and I haven't taken a single dollar. I don't get paid anything at all for going on this show every week.
Well, that's another thing, is a lot of these think tanks, that's a really good point you make, a lot of these think tanks, you have to look at where their funding comes from. They're always, like, they're almost, some of them, it seems like the majority of them receive a significant amount of funding from the UAE. A lot, like, I mean, the Center for American Progress receives a significant amount of funding from the United Arab Emirates, one of the most repressive governments, most tyrannical governments in the world. And not only that, but oftentimes they're receiving corporate money from weapons contractors, from cybersecurity companies, from sometimes they're receiving money from the State Department. There's, like, different mechanisms the State Department funds various think tanks. So it's like you always have to keep, like, a suspicious eye out when it comes to these kinds of findings. And oftentimes you'll see these are the people that are being quoted as experts in newspaper articles. They're, like, experts at this think tank, at the Brookings Institution, an expert on Russian cyber threats at this, you know, at the Institute for the Study of the Promotion of War. Like, you know, it's like it's like you gotta, that's almost always the case. They almost always, the Atlantic Council. The Atlantic Council receives a significant portion of its funding from NATO, as well as several various repressive governments that happen to be U.S. allies, as well as the U.S. government itself, and literally every major weapons company you can think of. So it's like, yeah, these people absolutely have an interest in pushing these points, and it's just amazing, like, the whole think tank industry has made it so that you can, like, basically launder like these corporate views through this, like, bullshit lens of, like, academia and of expertise, you know? It's so dangerous.
Not to mention that, like, at no point do I think Paul or myself or any of these people involved on the show were we ever, like, contacted by so one of the people involved, her name's Suzanne Spalding. She used to be a Homeland Security official under Barack Obama. You know, nobody's asked us for, like any questions about what we're doing, not even, like, accusatory, to try to, like, get to, you know, some kind of, you know, to try and expose Russia, so to speak. Nobody has reached out to ask us. So the final thing I'll say on this, and then we'll put this to rest for now until the next until I get accused of undermining democracy again, is that I love this part, though, toward the end, where these people who are promoting this thing say that we all have an obligation to go ahead and commit to the rule of law and the fundamental belief in our system of justice. We must work to improve our justice system and work to correct the perceived flaws. And basically saying that, like, even if Russia's doing this, we have to know that they're going to take advantage of our judicial shortcomings. That's how they describe it. And and that we, well, it's more than just shortcomings, but this is a nice way of downplaying the severity.
Well, quite a euphemism, yeah.
But I love this part, and I'm like, you know, yeah, I mean, but that's like my our show is like basically going on and on, and it's why probably we don't usually raise these issues, just because I've dealt with it weekly on this show instead of here. But, you know, it's talking about like why we need sentencing reform, why we need to reassess this whole thing of life in prison without parole, why we need to look at felon disenfranchisement, why we need to maybe not have life sentences or rethink how we do life sentences, or why we need much, much better prison health care because it's very barbaric there, or why we need to end censorship of like reading materials. Like, even prison legal news gets censored and they're not allowed to deliver their paper to people inside the prison door. You have like the author of the book on the Attica uprising gets banned from being read in state prisons in Illinois. And like, so, you know, if you want to like not look like you're living in a country that's run by some tyranny or whatever, then, you know, maybe you should take some of those things seriously. But obviously, like, CSIS doesn't care about those things. Like, the fact that they added this graph in their writing about this Russian conspiracy that they're hyping here is just window dressing, because it was just to make them look more legit and even-handed than they are, because they really don't care about mass incarceration in the United States. They just want to help people get more money to fight a common enemy.
Yeah, exactly.
So, all right. So this week, sadly, we had the death of Bill Blum, who was a very well-known, at least in left-wing circles, he was very well-known for his work. I also think the establishment knew of him, too, because they challenged their constant descriptions of empire building and the way they wage war, and challenged their histories of military interventions. But he was well-known as an anti-war advocate and someone who documented the United States foreign policy and how it promotes imperialism throughout the world. But why don't you just set him up a little bit more? You had some quotes from him you wanted to read, and then we're going to go through the way the New York Times decided to pay tribute to him.
Well, so, I mean, he's written many books that have, like, actually helped inform my perspective and understanding of imperialism. But he also has this website that he continued to update, the Anti-Empire Report. And I feel like these three short paragraphs explain, like, and like everything in such a nutshell. This is like, when did he write this? This is from November 3rd, 2015. And it's, he just like, this is, why does the government of the United States hate Syrian President Bashar al-Assad with such passion? Is it because, as we're told, he's a brutal dictator? But how can that be the reason for the hatred? It would be difficult indeed to name a brutal dictator of the second half of the 20th century, or the 21st century, that was not supported by the United States. Not only supported, but often put in power and kept in power against the wishes of the population. At present, the list would include Saudi Arabia, Honduras, Indonesia, Egypt, Colombia, Qatar, and Israel. The United States, I suggest, is hostile to the Syrian government for the same reason it has been hostile to Cuba for more than half a century, and hostile to Venezuela for the past 15 years, and earlier to Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia, and to Dominican Republic, Uruguay, and Chile, and so on, continuing through the world atlas and history books. What these governments have had in common can be summarized in a single word: independence. Independence from American foreign policy. The refusal to be a client state of Washington, the refusal to be continuously hostile to Washington's officially designated enemies, insufficient respect and zeal for the capitalist way of life. And I feel like that perfectly, like, in a nutshell, describes, like, everything he was about. He was about exposing, like, the hypocrisy and the crimes committed against countries who happen to be independent. And I just, and in case, like, he has this, it's like, he's actually kind of funny if you read his writing. It's he's a little humorous. So this is actually like a good reminder for just like the people listening. It's like a good argument to make. And he's like the guy who would compile lists of like the number of countries the U.S. has overthrown and stuff like that. So here's like another little blog post he wrote. Who are you going to believe, me or Dick Cheney? I've spent about 30 years compiling the details of the criminal record of the of U.S. foreign policy in concise lists. And I'm always looking for suitable occasions to present the information to new readers. The new book by Dick Cheney and his adoring daughter is such an occasion. And then he quotes Dick Cheney and Liz Cheney in their book saying, we are, as a matter of empirical fact and undeniable history, the greatest force for good the world has ever known. Security and freedom for millions of people around the globe have depended on America's military, economic, political, and diplomatic might. And then he's quoting Dick Cheney and Liz Cheney. And then he says, well, nothing short of a brain and soul transplant would change I don't actually know this word. It's like a word in a different language. Would change Dick Cheney and Liz Cheney and his carefully conditioned offspring, as he calls her. But for all of you out there who still live in a world of facts, logic, human rights, and human empathy, here's the ammunition to use if you should happen to find yourself ensnared in the embrace of the likes of the Cheney reptiles, including Mother Lynn, who once set up a website solely to attack me and seven others, yada, yada, yada. Anyway, so these are the lists, right? And I want people to listen very carefully and remember this. Since the end of World War II, the United States has attempted to overthrow more than 50 foreign governments, most of which were democratically elected, dropped bombs on the people of more than 30 countries, attempted to assassinate more than 50 foreign leaders, attempted to suppress a populist or nationalist movement in 20 countries, grossly interfered in democratic elections in at least 30 countries, plus, although not easily quantified, were involved in the practice of torture more than any other country in the world for over a century, not just performing the actual torture, but teaching it, providing the manuals, and furnishing the equipment. Anyways, I just wanted to read those, like, that just kind of, like are just a good reflection of the sort of work that he did. And I don't think there's anyone else who's done that, like, who's, like, compiled lists. Like, that was, like, a short list he made. But, like, I don't think there's anyone else doing that kind of work. And so he's just, like, a huge loss for anti-imperialism in the West.
He was my introduction to the, like, CIA overthrow, the meddling in governments, just the compendium of history that he would put together. He authored Killing Hope, which was very well known, covering U.S. military and CIA interventions since World War II. He also had a book, Rogue State, and it was sort of like a guide to all of the horrible acts of the United States in basically the past century. And these were very influential. He had a sort of like reputation of people in academia publicly resenting what he was doing, but privately he knew all of the people who were working on these subjects were reading his work because they knew that he was telling the truth, that this is actually what happens and has happened in history. So it's a tremendous loss. It's not a loss if you're the New York Times.
Okay, so this is where it gets crazy. Yeah, you got it in front of you?
I have it in front, and you know, normally I probably wouldn't take your time, but once I looked at the headline, which was flagged by several people, and then I started to read the obituary that was published for him. It's just insane. It's insane. I'll just lay a marker here. It's insane that anybody who dies, unless their names are Henry Kissinger or Dick Cheney or someone else of that caliber, someone who's been responsible for genocide or war crimes, unless and was able to engage in these acts and never be held accountable, unless that fits the template, you know, then I don't think you deserve this sort of zealous obituary and or this sort of like condescending very resentful obituary that was published here in the New York Times. It, like, nobody deserves that. Nobody deserves who dies to be remembered in such a contemptuous way. But obviously,
yeah, really disgusting. Really disgusting.
But you'll see here. So the New York Times, and the headline was nothing like about William Blum being just an anti-imperialist writer. Nothing of just like William Blum, U.S. policy critic and author of books, died. No, here it is. William Blum, U.S. policy critic cited by Bin Laden, dies at 85.
So disgusting. Like, that's just like...
That's the headline. Okay, and so then in the lead paragraph, that's what they lead with. William Blum, who raged against United States foreign policy in relative obscurity... Okay, relative obscurity. And they continue, four decades until one of his published anti-imperialist broadsides... Actually impressed that they actually use those words. They usually try to dance around and not call it what it is. Broadsides received a surge in sales thanks to a surprise public tribute from Osama bin Laden. And then they say he died on Sunday in Arlington, Virginia. He was 85. Okay, so basically they're saying the only reason why he's anyone that anybody knows is because bin Laden read his book.
Such assholes. Which it, like,
and okay, so then they mention his son. They go on to say he was a computer programmer for the State Department for some time. He took part in the Great Anti-Communist Crusade, is how he referred to it. He became disillusioned over the Vietnam War. So did many, many other people. After inaugurating a short-lived biweekly underground newspaper called the Washington Free Press, he joined in the anti-war protests, and then he quit his job in 1967. Then he wrote, and again, how they attack him, wrote largely polemical articles and columns for the Foreign Policy Journal and Counterpunch. And then they go on to say, and then they have this story, which is really, really, again, like, why is this in an obituary? Unless you want to make sure people think a dead person is trash, you don't put this kind of a story in an obituary. So here it is. Faking a flat tire near the gate to the Central Intelligence Agency headquarters in Virginia, he surreptitiously recorded the license plates of employees who were entering and leaving. He revealed the names and home addresses of more than 200 of them in his book, The CIA, A Forgotten History, U.S. Global Interventions Since World War II. They could have been spies, said Lewis Wolfe, a founder with Mr. Bloom in 1978 of what is now called Covert Action magazine. They could have been clerks. I don't know what the point is of that story other than to make him look like a total crank and lunatic. And also, I noticed that it would appear they're not including the full title of this book because this U.S. Global Intervention Since World War II, I think that's the Killing Hope book. Unless that book became Killing Hope later. But in 2006, he was interviewed by the Washington Post. He said his mission was ending, at least slowing down the American empire, or at least injuring the beast. Still, no one was more surprised than he when a recording emerged in 2006 in which Osama bin Laden recommended that all Americans read Mr. Bloom's book, Rogue State, A Guide to the World's Only Superpower, first published in 2000, and updated in 2005. It vaulted almost overnight from about 205,000 on Amazon sales ranking to the top 50. It stood at about 58,000 a few days after Mr. Blum's death. Again, like the whole idea that without bin Laden, who would really know who Mr. Blum was? And they quoted him because he had this like kind of funny quip about when he learned that bin Laden had said this about him, he said, "This is almost as good as being an Oprah book."